Chapter 43. Manhattan, New York, Sunday, July 4th, 2021. Avery's laptop sat open on the desk in the corner of her hotel room. The face of American Events executive producer and Avery's best friend, Christine Swanson, was on the screen linked through an online meeting app.
"What's going on?" Christine asked.
"You're going to think I'm crazy, but you're the only one I can share this with." Avery watched Christine on the monitor as she analyzed Avery's hotel room. After her meeting with Livia Cuddy, Avery had found a copy shop where she had each of Victoria Ford's manuscripts printed. Now, organized stacks of computer paper occupied the king-sized bed. On top of each stack rested a single paperback book. "I told you about Victoria Ford's sister, Emma."
"Right," Christine said.
"She had the recording of Victoria from the morning of 9/11. I can't wait to get my hands on it. We could do a lot of great stuff with it." Throughout her time in New York, Avery had kept Christine up to date on her discoveries regarding Victoria Ford and Cameron Young. "Great stuff" meant Christine and her team would produce the hell out of the recordings, making them both chilling and suspenseful. Avery imagined a short clip of Victoria Ford's voice playing just before a commercial break, anchoring 15 million viewers to their televisions in stunned silence.
"I know you'll make it amazing," Avery said, "but in addition to the recordings, Emma Kind also shared all this with me. Well, accidentally shared it."
She motioned to the stacks of paper.
"What is all that?" Christine asked, leaning toward the computer camera so her face filled the entire screen.
"Victoria Ford's manuscripts."
"Meaning books?"
"Yes, Victoria was a writer."
"My notes say she was a financial planner."
"Financial planning was her day job. Emma told me Victoria always wanted to write books. It had been her passion since she was a young girl, and was probably what drew her to Cameron Young. But Victoria never found any success. She wrote all these manuscripts but never landed a publisher. I found them on an old flash drive in one of the dusty bins Emma gave me of Victoria's yearbooks and memorabilia. I printed them out earlier today. To the best of my knowledge, these manuscripts have sat untouched and unread on that flash drive in Emma Kind's attic for the last 2 decades.
Christine nodded on the screen. "Okay. How is this related to the Cameron Young case?"
"I'm not sure yet. But here, look at this." Avery picked up one of the paper stacks. "This is Victoria Ford's first manuscript. The Word document indicates it was written in 1997. Working title is Hot Mess. Now, look at this," Avery said, placing the manuscript pages back onto the bed and picking up Natalie Ratcliffe's paperback novel. "This is a novel published by Hemingway Publishing in 2005 by an author named Natalie Ratcliffe."
"Baggage," Christine said. "Peg Perugo, I love those books."
"So you're a fan.
Then you're going to love this next part.
Baggage was published in 2005, the first in the Peg Perugo series, which, as you know, is amazingly successful, one of the most successful series in commercial fiction."
Christine raised her eyebrows as she waited for Avery to continue.
"Hot Mess. Baggage. Similar titles, right?" Avery asked. "Similar meanings, anyway."
"Sure.
So, here's the catch. Besides a change in title, the two stories are identical."
There was silence as Christine stared from the computer screen.
"What do you mean, identical?" she finally asked. "I mean, Victoria Ford's manuscript became the first book Natalie Ratcliffe published in the Peg Perugo series."
Christine shook her head. 100% not following you."
"Natalie Ratcliffe was Victoria Ford's best friend. They roomed together in college and stayed close after they graduated. Natalie went to medical school and practiced emergency medicine for 8 years. Victoria entered the financial world and started her own career. The whole time, Victoria was writing books, hoping someday to publish one of them."
"Yeah, still not following you," Victoria died in 2001. For the next 4 years, Natalie Ratcliffe practiced emergency medicine until her first book was published. It took the world by storm, and she retired from medicine. That was in 2005. She's written 15 novels in 15 years, but here's the problem, Avery said, walking over to the bed where Victoria's other manuscripts were stacked in neat batches, each with a Natalie Ratcliffe paperback on top. Every one of these piles represents one of Victoria's manuscripts, manuscripts that have sat untouched in Emma Kine's attic for the past 20 years. Each one also happens to be published as a Natalie Ratcliffe book. Christine squinted her eyes. So you're suggesting that Natalie Ratcliffe got a hold of Victoria Ford's manuscripts and plagiarized them, word for word, after Victoria died? No, I don't think so. Emma said Victoria was extremely protective of her work and didn't let anyone read her manuscripts. Emma has never read any of them. Not even Jasper Ford, Victoria's husband, was allowed to see them. Victoria was too insecure to let anyone read them. Then how did her work end up in the pages of Natalie Ratcliffe's novels? That's where you're going to think I've gone mad. Too late, Christine said. Just spit it out at this point. I've spent the weekend reviewing the case against Victoria Ford. It was flawed, no doubt, and I think I can poke some serious holes in it that will intrigue the American Events audience. I have more research to do on that front and plan to go through the rest of the case later today. But despite whatever holes I'm able to find, at the time of the original investigation, the hard evidence against Victoria was solid. DNA evidence put her at the scene. The media had all but convicted Victoria in the court of public opinion. There was no doubt that she would be indicted and arrested, and that a trial would follow. One that, based on the evidence Victoria knew about at the time, would have likely ended in her conviction. Okay, Christine said. Again, what do these manuscripts have to do with it? Victoria was in a dire situation. She knew the evidence pointed to her, and she knew on the morning of September 11th when she met with her attorney that it was only a matter of time before she was arrested. She knew that she would likely be convicted. According to my interview with Victoria's attorney, he laid out the grim prognosis for her that morning. Then, in the middle of Victoria's meeting with her attorney, the first plane struck the North Tower. Avery walked over to the desk where her laptop stood. She sat down in the chair and looked at Christine. And with that plane, an opportunity presented itself. An opportunity to do what? Christine asked. To disappear. Chapter 44. Manhattan, New York. Sunday, July 4th, 2021. Avery spoke the words with confidence. She knew Christine wouldn't believe that someone would fake their own death and disappear. But Avery had personal experience with someone disappearing to avoid indictment and prison. And she knew it was possible. Desperate people are capable of anything, and often find ways to convince the people who love them most to help. Disappear, meaning? Christine asked. Meaning Victoria used 9/11 to solve all her problems. You're saying what exactly, Ave? What if Victoria Ford didn't die that morning? I'm sorry, Avery. I love you, and we've been on some wild rides together, but this one might be too crazy for me to jump aboard. Just hear me out. She was sitting in Roman Manchester's office when the plane hit the tower. I know this from interviewing Manchester, who, along with 12 of his employees and 2 of his partners, made it safely out of the North Tower. He lived to tell his harrowing story of escaping the towers. Is it too far-fetched to believe the woman sitting across from him that morning also survived? Avery saw the first glimmer of conviction in Christine's eyes before she shook her head. But the medical examiner's office identified Victoria's remains. That's what sent you to New York in the first place. They identified a bone fragment that belonged to Victoria, yes. But I spoke with Livia Cuddy this morning and we took a closer look into the discovery. The specimen used to make the identification was a tooth.
A tooth?
Apparently, the medical examiner's office recovered thousands of bone fragments from the ruins of the towers, hundreds of which were teeth.
How is that even possible, Ave?
By filtering through the debris. Over the years, several sifting projects have been completed. The goal of these operations is to tediously sort through the rubble cleared from Ground Zero in order to find artifacts. Each time a sifting program is completed, more items are discovered. Wallets, driver's licenses, wedding rings, jewelry, bone fragments, and...
teeth.
Hundreds of them.
Good Lord.
Livia Cuddy tells me that most of these small bone fragments and teeth are still waiting to be matched to victims. So, if Victoria Ford was identified from a single tooth found in the rubble of the Twin Towers, and no other specimens have been matched to her, what if Victoria Ford was injured during the chaos of 9/11, as in she lost a tooth, but still managed to escape the towers? When Christine failed to respond, Avery continued. Thousands died when the towers collapsed, but thousands more made it safely out of the buildings. What if Victoria was one of them?
How? The hospitals were flooded that day. She never sought medical attention.
Maybe she didn't need it, Avery said. And if it were something as minor as a few broken or lost teeth, maybe her friend, who was an emergency medicine physician, helped her.
Natalie Ratcliffe.
Exactly, Avery said, standing up and walking over to the bed where Victoria's manuscripts rested. And in a crazy way, yes, a batshit crazy, Avery Mason Presents way, I think Victoria's manuscripts prove it.
Christine shook her head. I'll say one thing, your flair for the sensational is unparalleled. Make the connection for me.
Before I interviewed Natalie Ratcliffe, I bought a couple of her books so I could skim through them. One of them, Baggage, hooked me, and I read the whole thing. When I met with Emma Kind a second time, she pulled a bunch of old boxes out of her attic. They were filled with things from Victoria's childhood, and I planned to sort through the boxes to see if any of those things were useful for the documentary, to see if any of those items would help me paint a fuller picture of Victoria Ford. In one of the boxes, I found the flash drive that contained Victoria's manuscripts. As soon as I started reading the first one, I noticed the similarities to Natalie Ratcliffe's first novel. I went back to the bookstore and purchased Natalie's entire backlist and started skimming them. Avery pointed to the bed where a Natalie Ratcliffe novel rested on top of each of Victoria Ford's manuscripts. According to Emma, Victoria wrote 5 manuscripts. Each of those manuscripts ended up becoming a Natalie Ratcliffe novel, not just a similar storyline, but a verbatim text. It was in Victoria Ford's lost manuscripts that Peg Perugo was born.
Couldn't the explanation be that Victoria shared her manuscripts with Natalie Ratcliffe at some point before her death, maybe to get a friend's feedback? Then, after her friend died, Ratcliffe took the manuscripts as her own? And out of all this, Christine pointed at the bed, the only crime committed was plagiarism.
Except that Emma Kind swears Victoria didn't share her manuscripts with anyone, like I said, not even her husband.
Okay, Christine said. You've hooked me. Let's take Victoria Ford's sister at her word. No one ever saw Victoria's manuscripts. That explains the first 5 Ratcliffe books, which represent the 5 manuscripts Victoria wrote before 9/11. Where did the next 10 Ratcliffe books come from?
Avery took a deep breath. What if Victoria survived the morning of 9/11? She made it out of the North Tower, just like thousands of others. She was injured in the process and sought the help of her best friend, who was a physician. Then, as the enormity of events materialized that morning, a thought came to her. What if, in addition to watching one of the most infamous events in American history unfold,
Victoria Ford was also watching the opportunity to make her impossible situation go away. She'd already made the calls to Emma. The recordings were proof that she was in the North Tower. Then she asked Natalie not just for help with whatever injuries she sustained, but to help her disappear. Wherever Victoria is today, she's still writing manuscripts and sharing them with Natalie Ratcliffe.
Wow, Christine said. That's definitely Avery Mason-esque. But, I mean, it's been 20 years. How has an ER doctor and her best friend, a financial advisor, managed to keep this quiet for so long? And how did they pull it off in the first place? Where would Victoria Ford be hiding for 20 years? I haven't figured that out yet, but that's where I need your help. Avery smiled at Christine. You didn't have plans for the 4th of July, did you? I work for Avery Mason and American Events, Christine said. My personal life always comes last. I can't tell if you're saying that proudly or with a chip on your shoulder. Little bit of both. Tell me what you need. I'll do my best.
Chapter 45. Manhattan, New York, Sunday, July 4th, 2021.
Walt was perspiring, and the flow of blood through his throbbing carotid was audible inside his head as he walked through the front entrance of the Lowell Hotel on Sunday evening. He carried with him the cardboard box Scott Sherwood had fished from the cobwebbed corners of the BCI evidence room. The front desk clerk smiled as Walt checked in. The woman called up to Avery's room to let her know she had a guest. The clerk nodded her go-ahead, and Walt headed toward the elevator. He stopped at a dispenser to gulp down a glass of iced lemon water, noticing his hands tremor as he lifted the glass to his mouth. He was either out of practice as a surveillance agent for the FBI, or he knew somewhere inside that what he was about to do was wrong. In the elevator, he pressed the button for the 8th floor. The silver doors closed and reflected his image back at him. He noticed his forehead was covered with beads of sweat and felt his shirt stick to his back. Just prior to the doors opening, he wiped his forehead with his sleeve. He exited the elevator and walked down the hallway, stopping at room number 821. As he knocked, he remembered the question he had posed to Jim Oliver on Friday night. On what pretense would I end up in her hotel room? And now, here he was, the day after they'd slept together, standing outside her room with ill intentions of recording her private conversations. He wiped his forehead one more time, patted the breast pocket of his button-down to feel the small, flat, brushed metal box Jim Oliver had left for him. The door opened, and Walt lowered his hand from his pocket. "Hey," Avery said. Walt swallowed hard. "Hey." An ear-piercing concussion of silence followed their high school-type greeting. I missed you this morning, Walt finally said. Sorry if I was comatose.
No, Avery said, shaking her head. I snuck out.
Oh, okay.
I needed a jog.
Yeah, makes sense. I'm just glad, you know, everything's okay.
Avery closed her eyes momentarily. I had an immature moment of panic. I should have told you I was leaving. Look, Walt, if you haven't already guessed, I'm not the greatest at this, and I'm mortified to admit that it's been quite a while since I've been in this sort of situation.
I'm not sure that's something to be mortified about, and the same is true for me. I've been hiding in Jamaica for 3 years. Plus, I'm twice divorced, so I'm no better at this than you are.
Avery moved her hands back and forth between them.
Then can we agree that this greeting has been awkward enough? Let's just get back to normal?
Done. Walt held up the box. We've got a lot to cover.
Good. Come on in.
Walt followed Avery into the room. It consisted of a king-sized bed, and on the far end near the windows, a coffee table in front of a small sofa, as well as a desk and chair. Ignore the mess,
Avery said, motioning to the bed, where stacks of paper stood in distinct piles on top of the comforter.
What's all this?
Research.
Looks like you've been busy.
You too, Avery said as she sat on the sofa. What did you find?
Walt sat next to her and placed the box on the coffee table.
It's a long story, but I made some calls and managed to track down some more files on the Cameron Young case.
In addition to what we went through last night?
Yeah. This was stuff only the DA had. I want to show you something.
Walt reached into the box and riffled through the folders until he found the one he wanted. He placed it on the table and opened it. Inside were photos of Victoria Ford from her initial interview with detectives. Walt fingered through them so they spread across the table. Avery leaned closer to the photos. What am I looking at?
These are photos of Victoria Ford during our first formal interview with her. They were taken 2 days after Cameron Young was killed when we brought her into BCI headquarters to question her.
Intake photos?
Yes.
Intake photos were counted as evidence and taken of potential suspects in the early hours and days of an investigation. They were meant to document the presence of wounds, cuts, or bruises a person of interest may have had on their body. That would suggest they had been in a recent struggle or altercation. The photos on the table showed Victoria in her bra and underwear. The first showed her standing with arms bent at 90 degrees, as if surrendering at gunpoint. Another captured her in a wide stance, feet shoulder length apart, and her arms straight out to the sides, crucifix style. Other photos were close-ups of her shoulders and neck. The photo Walt pointed to was of Victoria's hands, posed with her fingers spread apart.
I don't see anything, Avery said.
Exactly. Your argument last night about the lack of blood on the rope got me thinking. How could Victoria have cut herself badly enough to drip so much blood on the carpeting, but leave no trace of blood on the rope?
Avery slowly moved her gaze back to the photos of Victoria's hands. She didn't cut herself.
It doesn't look like it. And you're looking at the proof. These photos were taken 2 days after the murder. There's no way a wound would heal that quickly.
So where did the blood come from?
It's a very good question, Walt said. One that I don't have an answer to.
Chapter 46. Manhattan, New York. Sunday, July 4th, 2021. Avery continued to look through the pictures. Where did these photos come from? Why weren't they in the original file?
That's the other thing I wanted to talk to you about. Something's been bothering me ever since I dove back into the Cameron Young case and stirred up the memories of that investigation.
What is it? Avery said.
When I was tapped to investigate this homicide, I was young. I wasn't dumb, but I was inexperienced in running a homicide investigation. I was well-trained and had been part of other homicides for the BCI, but never as the lead detective. The Cameron Young investigation was my first solo case. And even looking back now, I don't think I would change much. My job was to present the evidence I found to the district attorney's office. I didn't offer opinions or speculation. I just followed the evidence and then turned it over. I was good at procedure. Find the evidence, log the evidence, get the warrants, supply the warrants. I did everything by the book. What I was bad at were the politics involved in our criminal justice system. The DA was a woman named Maggie Greenwald. She had a reputation as a fierce prosecutor who was on the rise. She was aggressive, demanding, and had political aspirations far beyond the district attorney's office. Rumors had her pegged for the next attorney general or governor. But to get that kind of shot and gather the support needed to forge a serious run, she needed to make headlines as the DA. Headlines come from quickly resolving cases. And if a high-profile case comes your way, even better. Maggie Greenwald was all over the Cameron Young case from the very beginning and wanted things done quickly.
She chose me to run the investigation. I was handpicked and quite proud of it. And I took the responsibility seriously.
Roman Manchester, Victoria Ford's attorney, told me that Maggie Greenwald had a knack for, how did he put it? Fitting square evidence into round holes.
I didn't know that about her at the time she tapped me to run the Cameron Young investigation. I found that out only after I left the BCI to join the Bureau. She got herself into a little trouble.
She was disbarred for suppressing evidence, so it was more than a little trouble.
Walt nodded. One of her biggest convictions got overturned when new DNA evidence was found. The defendant had served years in prison. And it wasn't just new evidence that surfaced, it was evidence that had been there from the beginning. Greenwald suppressed it. The only reason the truth came out was because her ADA grew a conscience and blew the whistle on her.
She withheld evidence?
Yes.
How could she live with herself knowing that she put an innocent man in prison?
Prosecutors, some of them, believe the deck is and always has been stacked against them. They see guilty defendants getting off on technicalities. They see rock-solid cases go the other way because of reasonable doubt, despite how unreasonable it sounds to them. So some of them try to even the playing field.
By lying? Or hiding evidence?
Sometimes. And Maggie Greenwald was determined to make a name for herself. Since the whistleblower came forward, some of her biggest cases have been overturned after evidence was found that had been suppressed. The U.S. Attorney's Office from the Southern District of New York got involved and began a formal investigation. They subpoenaed all her cases and all her records. They found four other cases where she tried to make evidence disappear, or where she withheld evidence during discovery. It was enough to get her disbarred and end her career, legal and political. The Innocence Project and other wrongful conviction advocacy groups have taken up all of her convictions and are taking a hard look at them.
Victoria Ford wasn't one of them?
No, Walt said. First, Victoria was never formally convicted, so there's nothing to overturn. And second, sadly, without a conviction, no one really cares about it.
I care.
I know you do.
And Emma Kind cares.
I know that, too. And she's lucky to have you digging through the case. I just wanted to give you the full picture as to why the files I showed you yesterday didn't tell the whole story. This box, Walt pointed at the table, has been in the DA's possession until the U.S. Attorney's Office subpoenaed all of Greenwald's files. They took a hard look at each of them, but passed on digging into the case against Victoria Ford. The Southern District of New York shipped this box back to the BCI, where it has sat for years. And now, as I root back through the details, I can't help thinking that for such a high-profile homicide, I was tapped early on to run the investigation. Maggie Greenwald requested me. At the time, I was honored. I thought I'd made such an impression that she picked me for my talent. But a little time and perspective tells me that maybe she picked me because I was young and green, and because she could manipulate me in ways another more experienced detective would not have allowed.
You didn't do anything wrong, Walt. You followed the evidence, and no one can fault you for that. You didn't plant evidence, and you certainly didn't suppress it. The crime scene you found led to Victoria Ford, not by hunch, not by speculation, but by forensically backed evidence. You didn't make any mistakes. You didn't manipulate the evidence.
No, but I'm wondering if I was manipulated. This case went up in smoke after 9/11, and when the dust settled, everyone had moved on. Soon after, I was recruited into the FBI, and I never really put much thought into it after that. But now, 20 years later, with the things you and I have uncovered, I'm starting to wonder if a dead woman was branded a killer when, in fact, she was innocent.
The narrative that 20 years earlier an aggressive district attorney had focused on the wrong woman in the death of Cameron Young
was starting to play out in Avery's mind. She had no way to prove who had killed Cameron Young, only that there was a very realistic possibility it was not Victoria Ford. Avery knew her viewing audience would salivate over every detail. And things were about to get even juicier. Walt gathered the files and the photos and returned them to the box. "There's one more thing I came across in this box of lost evidence," Walt said, holding up a plastic evidence bag. It held a thumb drive.
"What is it?"
"The sex video of Cameron Young and Victoria Ford." Chapter 47. Manhattan, New York, Sunday, July 4th, 2021. "It's been 20 years, Walt said, holding up the evidence bag. "But I still remember it vividly.
"I've got to see it," Avery said.
"You sure?"
"I'm sure. I need to see if any of it can be aired in prime time."
"From what I remember, you'll need to blur most of it out.
I've got a really good technical crew and an even better producer."
"Grab your laptop."
Avery retrieved her laptop from the desk where she had positioned it earlier in the day for her meeting with Christine. She rested it on the coffee table in front of where they both sat on the sofa. Walt placed the drive into the port and clicked open the file. The video started.
"Oh, God," Avery said, as Cameron Young's naked backside materialized on the screen. "I told you you'd have to blur most of it out."
Avery continued to watch until Victoria Ford appeared on the screen. Avery pinched her eyebrows together when she saw the dominatrix outfit, complete with a dangerous-looking spiked necklace and wristbands. Victoria's naked breasts poked through the holes of the leather suit she wore.
"How many times have you seen this?"
"Just once," Walt said, "and only part of it. Once we identified Victoria Ford, I left to interview her."
Avery sat in stunned silence as she watched Victoria Ford pace back and forth next to her vulnerable prey. Avery had trouble reconciling the woman Emma Kind had described and the one whom Avery had heard on the answering machine recordings with the woman she saw in the video. Her breath caught when she saw Victoria bring up the tasseled object in her right hand.
"What is that?"
"I believe it's called a flogger whip," Walt said. "That whip, or a similar one, is what caused the violent welt marks on Cameron Young's body that were noted in the autopsy. Should I turn it off?"
"No. So this is how you figured out they were having an affair?"
Walt nodded. "Yes, from the paraphernalia found at the crime scene, we knew Cameron Young was at least having a single night of dangerous sex. His wife claimed during my initial questioning of her that she and Cameron had never participated in any type of S&M sex. Discovering the video allowed us to zero in on Victoria Ford as his lover."
Avery cocked her head to the side as she watched the screen and voyeuristically spied on Victoria and her lover. "Where did this video take place?"
"In Cameron Young's writing studio."
"Why is it so off-centered?"
"On the monitor, the action took place in the far right-hand side of the shot, as if the camera were pointed slightly in the wrong direction." "I don't know," Walt said. "Maybe they didn't have good producers like you. It's a homemade sex tape, not a cinematic production."
On the screen, Victoria Ford slapped the whip against her lover's back and shoulders. To Avery, it looked more playful than violent. She watched Victoria move down Cameron's body and tap him again with the whip, this time on the buttocks and upper thighs. Then she stopped.
"Wait a second," Avery said. "Rewind it."
Walt looked at the screen. "The video?"
"Yeah, rewind it a bit."
Walt ran his finger over the mouse pad and clicked the reverse arrow until the movie ran backward for a few seconds.
"There," Avery said.
She watched the screen as Victoria brought the tasseled whip down across Cameron Young's backside. About to strike again, Victoria instead stopped and walked forward where she bent down to place her ear by his mouth.
"Play that part again and turn the volume up," Avery said.
Walt rewound again and increased the volume. This time, when Victoria brought the whip down, the muffled voice of Cameron Young could be heard. The word he spoke was difficult to make out. But as soon as he uttered it, Victoria lowered the whip and bent down to speak to him.
"What did he say?" Avery asked.
Walt shook his head. "I couldn't make it out." He reversed the video again, and they both leaned forward to listen more carefully. The whistle of the whip preceded a stinging thwack. Then Cameron Young spoke the single word.
"Cinnamon."
"Cinnamon?" Walt said. "Did he say cinnamon?"
"He did," Avery said.
"What the hell does that mean?" Avery looked over at Walt.
"It's their safe word."
Walt raised his eyebrows.
"Couples who partake in BDSM sex create a safe word, a random word they utter whenever things are getting too rough or dangerous. As soon as the word is spoken, the game is over."
On the monitor, Victoria Ford crouched down next to Cameron Young, dropped the whip on the floor, and unbuckled the restraints that held his wrists to the bottom of the boarding horse. A moment earlier, she was delivering what Avery interpreted as playful punishment, but one slash of the whip had gone too far, and they quickly ended things. Now she was rubbing his back.
"Are you okay?"
Victoria's voice came through loudly from the speakers. Too loudly, as Walt had maxed out the volume a moment earlier, trying to capture Cameron Young's muffled voice. He quickly turned the volume down. On the screen, Cameron Young climbed off the apparatus, and he and Victoria walked off screen. A door could be heard opening, likely the bathroom. The video played on in silence.
"He got spooked," Avery said. "It looked pretty innocent until that last strike with the whip. It went a little too far."
Walt sat back on the couch, rubbing a hand over his chin. Finally, he looked at Avery. "So their role-playing had limits."
"It appears that way."
"Which doesn't jive with the crime scene and the violent whip marks noted on Cameron Young's body." Avery and Walt continued to stare at the monitor. The spanking horse sat in the otherwise empty shot of the studio. Victoria and Cameron had disappeared a few seconds earlier.
"Why didn't they stop the video when they were done?" Avery asked.
"What do you mean?"
"They were supposedly creating a sex tape to watch back later for their own kicks. But when things went too far and the fun ended, why didn't one of them stop the camera?"
The screen suddenly went black. Avery noticed the confused look on Walt's face as he leaned over and tapped the mouse pad to rewind the video to the spot where Victoria and Cameron walked off screen. He pointed to the timer on the bottom of the screen, and then fast-forwarded the video until just before the screen went blank.
60 seconds, he said. "Exactly 60 seconds.
"What's that mean?" Avery asked.
"Motion-activated cameras are triggered when the sensor detects movement. They continue recording as long as motion is detected. When the movement stops triggering the sensor, the camera shuts off after 60 seconds.
Avery looked over at him, and then it hit her.
"That's why the shot was off-centered. They didn't know they were being recorded."
Chapter 48, Manhattan, New York, Sunday, July 4th, 2021.
They both needed a break after watching the video of Victoria Ford and Cameron Young. Avery stepped into the bathroom to freshen up after Walt suggested they find a proper bar that served proper drinks. It wasn't the video that had him thirsting for alcohol, but the conclusions they had made during the viewing. Watching the video today, far removed from his role as lead detective on the case, and without the enormous pressure he felt at the time to find answers, it was easy to see that the video had been recorded in secret. It was easy to see that neither Victoria nor Cameron knew they were being recorded. Walt lifted the plastic evidence bag that had contained the thumb drive and read the writing scrawled across it, indicating the date and time the evidence had been logged.
The label on the bag also included the location where the thumb drive had been found, in the desk drawer of Tessa Young's office at the Catskills Mansion. Why, Walt wondered, would Cameron Young make a sex video of himself and his mistress and then keep it in his wife's desk drawer? Combined with the other problems he and Avery had uncovered about the case, the revelations they made about the video were enough to make him believe he'd gotten his first homicide investigation terribly wrong. Was it worse that the accused was dead rather than in prison? If convicted and incarcerated, at the very least, there was hope that some sliver of justice could still be served by bringing the new evidence forward and attempting to overturn the conviction. In this case, though, there was no way to provide Victoria Ford with justice. Posthumous exonerations were as valuable as winning a lottery ticket one day past its expiration date. Walt pulled the thumb drive out of the computer and dropped it back into the evidence bag. Then he suddenly realized that with Avery in the bathroom, 2 hours after he'd arrived at the Lowell, he was alone in her hotel room. He still sat on the small sofa with Avery's laptop open on the coffee table in front of him. He looked around the room. He examined the bed where the stacks of Avery's research rested in separate piles. He noticed a paperback novel on the top of each pile of paper. On the desk near the window was another heap of papers. Next to the laptop on the coffee table were pages containing the details of the Victoria Ford identification. Walt reached for his breast pocket. This time, he did not just feel for the small, thin box that was there. He removed it and held it in his hand. His heart rate picked up. Simply holding the listening devices caused a visceral reaction inside him. The past 3 years of his life had been tormented by deceit, by the ravages of losing a woman who had kept secrets from him and betrayed him in a way that was nearly unforgivable. As he stared at the listening devices, he wondered if he were any better than Megan Cobb. His gaze roamed the room, moving from the nightstand that held the telephone and alarm clock to the closed bathroom door, and back to the coffee table in front of him. As the analytical part of his mind calculated the most strategic places to secure the listening devices, one under the lip of the nightstand, one under the coffee table, and one in the bathroom in case Avery used her cell phone there, some other part of his mind screamed for him not to do it. Walt took a deep breath, rubbed the back of his neck, and set the metallic box on the edge of the coffee table. He was lost in conflicted thought when he noticed the postcard among Avery's research. It looked to have been ripped to shreds and then painstakingly taped back together. The pieces mostly fit, at least to return continuity to the postcard, but the edges were poorly exposed and uneven. He lifted it off the table and inspected it. A short message was written on the back of the card. To the one and only clairvoyant, just hanging out and watching the events of America, could use some company. On the bottom of the card, Walt saw three numbers scrawled innocuously, almost as if they were an afterthought. 777. Walt flipped the card back over to inspect the front. Pieced together and taped over was a picture of a wooded cabin set among trees, where leaves had been turned ginger by autumn. The handle of the bathroom door clicked. The noise startled him, and the postcard slipped from his grip and fell to the floor. Its momentum took it under the couch. Before he had a chance to retrieve it, Avery stepped in the vestibule outside the bathroom.
"You ready?" she asked.
Walt stood quickly.
"Yeah."
His heart pounded, and the perspiration returned to his forehead. As he walked across the hotel room and toward the door, he passed Avery and headed out into the hallway. She closed the door behind them and checked that it was locked.
"You want to head back to the rum house?" she asked.
Walt nodded. "Sure, sounds good." They stepped into the elevator and Avery pressed the button for the lobby. As the doors closed, Walt again saw his reflection in the clear metal. It was then that he realized he'd left the thin metal box and the listening devices it held on the edge of the coffee table.
Chapter 49, Manhattan, New York, Sunday, July 4th, 2021.
A two-man band, pianist and violinist, played in the corner of the bar. After they ordered drinks, Avery headed over to put in a request. Walt sat alone at the bar, sipping a Worthy Park single estate reserve, and contemplating the predicament he'd found himself in. It felt like weeks, not days, since he'd sat in this tavern and met Avery Mason for the first time. Back then, he was anxious to get back in the middle of an operation, get his mind off the wallowing thoughts of Megan Cobb's betrayal, and work his way out of the funk of self-pity and anger he was in. When he sat in this bar on Tuesday night, Walt was excited to have been tapped by the Bureau to play such an important role in a case that had stumped them. That Jim Oliver had gone to such lengths to find and recruit him had given Walt a sense of purpose, a sense of being needed. It was a feeling that had been absent from the past 3 years of his life. Now, he couldn't help but make the comparison to when he was a 28-year-old kid tapped to run a high-profile homicide investigation. The thought crossed his mind that he was being manipulated today in much the same way he had been 20 years earlier. He'd fallen for the romanticism of it all. A delicate case, a top target, and the glory that would come from a successful operation. That he'd have to put his ethics aside and quell any moral objections that arose was simply part of the job, Jim Oliver had convinced him. And now Walt had gone and made a goddamn mess of things. He was sleeping with the woman who was under his surveillance. Worse than that, he was feeling something for her. The crushing burden of guilt had sat heavy on his shoulders on the walk over from Avery's hotel. Walt worked hard to convince himself that he had not slept with Avery out of any hell-bent effort to obtain information from her. It was spontaneous and unplanned. It had happened in the heat of the moment. But that was then, and this is now, he thought. The way the rest of tonight had to play out put him in knots. He'd left the listening devices on the coffee table in her hotel room and had no choice but to return there to retrieve them. Once there, the inevitable would likely follow. It would be then that Walt Jenkins, in his own mind, would have crossed the line. On top of his guilt was a combination of curiosity and confusion about how his relationship with Avery could end in anything other than disaster. He was on an operation sprung by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and choreographed to intentionally set his life on a collision course with Avery Mason, a.k.a. Claire Montgomery, the express purpose of which was to deceive her into believing he was interested in her story about Victoria Ford. All the while, his true goal would be to burrow his way far enough into her personal life so that he might find a scrap of evidence that would shed light on the whereabouts of her father. The entire scenario begged the question of whether Walt was any better than Megan Cobb. "Now there's a man lost in his thoughts," Avery's voice snapped him back from his trance. Walt smiled at her. "Just zoning out." Avery opened her eyes excitedly and placed a finger to her ear as the two-man band began to play "The Wait" by the band.
"I just requested this."
"Great song," Walt said, turning to look over his shoulder at the musicians. "I've never heard it played with a violin. Sounds good."
Avery took the stool next to him.
"What were you thinking about?"
A loaded question, Walt thought. He spun his glass a few more times before answering. "The strange road of life," he finally said. "I was thinking about how we each came to this place in our lives, sitting with each other here in this empty city."
Avery took a sip of vodka.
"Strange is one word for that road. Really, screwed up would be a better descriptor, though."
"Your road is that bad?"
"Not bad, just complicated," Avery said. "I was supposed to be a lawyer for my father's firm. Being on television was never part of my 5-year plan."
"Really? How did the American Events thing happen?" By accident.
Walt noticed her pause, as if she were about to say something before thinking better of it. He felt a sudden urge to tell Avery everything he knew about her, everything he had learned from the dossier Jim Oliver had delivered to him. He wanted to tell her that he knew all about the Montgomery family, that he knew her mother and brother were dead, and that her father had disappeared while under federal indictment, that he knew everything about her past, and that she didn't need to go through the painful process of sharing it with him or figuring out what not to tell him, that he wasn't the person she believed him to be, but something worse. Before any of his thoughts formed to words, Avery spoke again.
Your story about Megan the other night got me thinking that you and I have a lot in common.
How so?
We both ran away. You just did a better job of hiding than I did.
Walt said nothing, just waited for her to continue.
You've been in New York for what, a week now? Have you called her? Does Megan know you're in town?
This conversation had taken a sudden turn Walt hadn't expected. He shook his head. No.
Why not?
I'm not ready to call her.
What are you running from?
What are you running from?
Being pressed on his relationship with Megan had brought an edge to his voice. He was about to apologize when Avery spoke. Ever heard of Garth Montgomery?
Walt had never been a strong poker player, and bluffing was not his forte. He was sure the shocked look on his face when Avery mentioned her father's name had not gone unnoticed. Still, he did his best to recover. The thief of Manhattan?
Shit, she said with a laugh. I forgot about that nickname. But yeah, that's him.
What about him?
He's my father.
Walt blinked a few times, but couldn't think of a reasonable question to ask.
Claire Montgomery is my actual name. Claire Avery Montgomery. When I moved to L.A. to write for the Times, I used Avery Mason in my byline. It stuck.
Walt shook his head. Start from the beginning.
After my father was arrested and indicted, I had to get out of New York. On top of stealing billions of dollars from innocent people, my father also had a second life with another woman. I don't know what I hate him more for. To think the man who used to call me the clairvoyant one, the nickname he gave me for my supposed ability to see through his bullshit, had a secret life away from his wife and kids, was a betrayal worse than anything he could have stolen.
Walt's mind flashed to the shredded postcard patched together with scotch tape he found in Avery's room. The message on it had been addressed to the one and only clairvoyant.
I knew my law degree was worthless. No reputable firm was going to hire Garth Montgomery's daughter, so I fell back on my journalism degree. I moved to California and took a job at the LA Times. I broke a big case about a missing kid in Florida, and it got a lot of attention. I was invited to appear on American Events to tell the story. Matt Carter and I hit it off. Soon I was guest hosting once a week, covering other missing persons' stories and the like.
As Avery Mason.
She nodded. I found my niche with a strange combination of morbidly fascinating cases and the inspirational.
Like the lady who crashed into the lake and managed to save her four kids.
Avery smiled. You really are a fan of the show.
Walt nodded. He waited for her to continue.
Last summer, Matt Carter died while on assignment, and HAP News tapped me to take over. I agreed because there was no way I could turn the opportunity down. It's been a year now, and there have been lots of stories about my success after taking over for one of America's most beloved news magazine hosts. I found myself in this sort of whirlpool I couldn't get out of. No one's made the connection to my father yet, but sooner or later, someone will.
Avery lifted her vodka.
So, that's what I'm running from. No one knows about your father? Walt asked.
People know. I spent 29 years as Claire Montgomery, creating a life and laying down roots. I'm still very much Claire Montgomery. I've heard from plenty of friends and former classmates who watch the show. The network sends my checks to Claire Montgomery. It's a common enough name that no one important has made the connection yet. But it'll happen. At some point, it'll happen. The only reason it hasn't yet is because my popularity is too new and came too quickly. If you add up all the people who know me as Garth Montgomery's daughter, you might come to, what, a couple hundred? 1,000? Do we each personally know 1,000 people? The American events audience who knows me as Avery Mason is 15 million strong.
So what happens when it comes out?
I don't know. Maybe nothing. Maybe I lose it all. I just finished my first full season as host of AE. There hasn't been a lot of time for my past to come out. But the reality is that I can't hide nearly 30 years of life.
Why would you? You don't need to hide anything. So you have a shitty father. Join the crowd.
Avery laughed. Mine's shittier than most, and infamous.
So what? None of it was your fault. None of his sins are a reflection on you. You're an investigative journalist who has a wildly popular show. Why are you hiding anything?
I didn't plan to hide anything, not really. This whole thing happened so fast that I haven't had time to right the ship.
So, get out in front of it. That's how these things are handled and put quickly to rest. That this part of your past exists is not the problem. Hiding it is.
I plan to. Get out in front of it, but...
Walt waited. But what?
He saw Avery hesitate, and sensed she was choosing her words carefully.
But what?
He asked again. But I have a few things to take care of first.
Chapter 50, Manhattan, New York, Sunday, July 4th, 2021.
It was 9:30 p.m. when they left the Rum House. Their next destination was not discussed, but they headed back toward the Lowell. As they walked, they heard a pop behind them, turned, and saw the cascading streaks of an arching firework far off in the distance. The fireworks display was staged near the Brooklyn Bridge and set off from barges on the East River. A pinwheel rocketed into the sky and expanded into a burst of brightness. The subtle boom came a second later, delayed by having to travel halfway up the island of Manhattan to reach them. They stood quietly and watched for a minute. Walt felt Avery take his hand and intertwine her fingers with his. After a few minutes, they turned and headed to Avery's hotel. When they reached the front entrance, Avery tugged and he followed her inside. The elevator deposited them on the 8th floor. Walt felt his shirt begin to stick to his back again, and preemptively blotted his forehead with the back of his hand. He followed Avery down the hallway and stood behind her as she unlocked the door. Following her through the entryway, he spotted the thin metal box on the edge of the coffee table. To him, it was as obvious as if another person were standing in the room waiting for them. "Make yourself comfortable," Avery said. "I'll be right out." As soon as the bathroom door closed, Walt exhaled, allowing his shoulders to relax and his chin to drop to his chest. He hurried over and grabbed the box. If he planned to plant the bugs, now would be the time to do it. It took him only a fraction of a second to decide against it. He would not allow Avery's private conversations to be recorded. Jim Oliver could go to hell. He dropped the box into his pocket just as Avery walked from the bathroom. He checked his watch. "You know what? I think I'm going to get going." Avery walked over to him and put her hands on his chest. She kissed his lips, and all the guilt and apprehension Walt had felt earlier in the night evaporated. He pulled her close so their hips touched. Then he lifted her off her feet and carried her a few paces until they fell onto the bed. The pages of Victoria Ford's manuscripts flew like confetti into the air. Neither noticed.
Chapter 51. Manhattan, New York, Monday, July 5th, 2021. They jogged the trails through Central Park on Monday morning. When they had woken 30 minutes earlier, the awkwardness from the previous morning was gone. Avery had felt no need to sneak out. Instead, she leaned over his sleeping body and whispered in his ear, "I need a run." Walt slivered an eye open.
"Is that your way of making me leave?"
"No, I just don't want you to think I snuck out again. Want to come with?"
"I'll have to grab shorts and shoes for my hotel."
"Central Park. Meet you at Columbus Circle in 20 minutes. As they jogged now, Avery could see that the paths were more congested than they had been over the weekend. Tuesday would mark the return to normal, and before long the city would be as crowded as always. A tinge of melancholy soured her stomach. The past weekend had felt like some sort of oasis that belonged just to her and Walt. It had started with dinner at Keene's, and was, sadly, ending this morning. In addition to reviewing the Cameron Young case, they had shared painful secrets about their pasts. Aside from Connie Clarkson, Walt was the first person Avery had discussed her father with. He hadn't seemed stunned or scared or appalled or any of the other reactions Avery imagined people having when they found out who her father was. The truth, Avery finally understood, was that Walt's reaction was normal. Her father's crimes were not a reflection of who she was. They ended their run at 9 a.m., and each headed back to their hotel to shower and change. Avery arrived at the restaurant first and was seated at a table for two on the outdoor patio. She sipped coffee and scrolled through her phone. Christine Swanson had gotten back to her on the research Avery had asked her to do on Natalie Ratcliffe. Christine believed in only two modes of communication— text messages, or face-to-face meetings. And so, when Avery checked her phone, she found it filled with foot-long texts from Christine, containing links to articles and stories about Natalie Ratcliffe, her husband, and his wealthy family, along with Christine's own commentary. As Avery scrolled, she learned that Natalie Ratcliffe wrote books for the pure joy of storytelling, not due to any fiduciary obligation to support her family. Her in-laws more than had life's finances covered. The Ratcliffes owned and operated the second-largest cruise line conglomerate in the United States, the fourth-largest in the world. But unlike the other behemoths in the industry, Ratcliffe International Cruise Lines was privately owned with no outside money. Avery scrolled through the texts and found a link to Forbes magazine's 2019 list of wealthiest Americans. The Ratcliffe clan held several spots. Natalie Ratcliffe's husband, Don, was worth $1.4 billion, and the posh apartment at 157 suddenly made more sense to Avery. Natalie's father-in-law and the longtime CEO of Ratcliffe Enterprises held a healthy $3.5 billion net worth. Avery looked up from her phone, took a sip of coffee, and contemplated her far-fetched idea about Natalie Ratcliffe and her friend Victoria Ford. As she mulled the possibilities and worked to connect the dots, she spotted Walt walking along the sidewalk toward the entrance of the restaurant. Out of his running shoes and sweaty shirt, he wore khakis and a dressed-up t-shirt. He had the build of a man who kept himself in shape, and she noticed again how attractive he was. Not for the first time this weekend, Avery wondered what the hell she was doing.
"I'm sorry?" the waitress asked.
Avery, suddenly aware that she had spoken her thoughts aloud, cleared her throat.
"Oh, nothing. Sorry, actually." Avery turned over the mug opposite her. "My breakfast mate just arrived."
"Breakfast mate?" The waitress smiled and poured from a carafe of coffee she carried. Avery emptied two cream containers into Walt's coffee and stirred as her mind continued to run. She had come to New York to procure a falsified passport from the man she had been put in touch with named Andre.
the only person, she was told, who could be trusted for such a task. Andre didn't have the greatest bedside manner, Avery had been warned, but she should trust him explicitly and listen to anything he had to tell her. She had come to New York under the ruse of chasing the story of Victoria Ford. Both projects were now in full swing and would command much of her concentration, and yet here she was, starting a relationship with a man who lived in Jamaica and who came back to New York once a year to exorcise the demons that still haunted him from a previous relationship. If there was ever a playbook for failure, Avery was following it. Still, she couldn't stop images from the previous night from flashing in her mind. She quickly shook the memories away as she watched Walt walk onto the outdoor patio. He smiled when he spotted her. As he sat down across from her, Avery removed the spoon from his coffee mug. "Two creams, no sugar," she said. Walt's face carried a curious look.
"Good guess. But what if I took my coffee black?"
"You don't." Walt looked at her with a creased forehead. "It's a weird thing with me. I pay attention to other people's coffee habits. I saw two empty creams on the coffee bar in your hotel room on Saturday. Sugars were untouched."
Walt slowly nodded. "Very creepy, but I sort of like it."
The waitress came and they ordered breakfast.
"Streets are getting full," Walt said,
looking at the people who walked past the outdoor cafe and the traffic in the street. "I know, it's sort of sad. The city sort of felt like it belonged to just the two of us for the last couple of days. Now everyone's coming back to intrude."
"We accomplished a lot, and now that our weekend is over, we need to figure out where to go from here. This is your project, Avery. I just agreed to provide access to the case files. But we've poked some serious holes in the investigation, and now I feel an obligation to do more. I want to reach out to some people and discuss what we've found. I'm not sure where that might lead, but the Cameron Young case is technically still open. A district attorney or a congressman or a senator somewhere might care enough to put some resources into it. I can work my contacts and see if anyone is willing to listen."
"That would be great. I appreciate anything you can do, and Emma Kind will be thrilled. But despite everything we've uncovered this weekend, I can't get past the fact that Victoria's blood was found at the scene. No matter how many holes we poke in the investigation or how many other potential suspects we come up with, her blood is a hard obstacle to overcome. Whether we try to get the case reopened or if I just cover it on American Events, the blood is an issue. I spoke with Livia Cuddy yesterday morning to ask about the science behind DNA evidence. She said that if the blood at the crime scene matched the DNA sample taken from Victoria's mouth swab, it's her blood. 100%, or very close to it. So we might be able to prove that Victoria didn't cut herself with the knife, but that doesn't disprove that the blood at the scene belonged to her."
"You know," Walt said, "I was suspicious this weekend, but I'm convinced this morning. There's something we're missing, and I think I know someone who might be able to help us find it."
"Who?"
Let's call him an old friend. I tracked him down, and he's agreed to meet me. I'm heading there after breakfast."
"About the blood?"
"And a couple other things. Let's chase our leads for a couple of days and touch base later in the week. See what we each come up with."
"Perfect," Avery said. She needed a little time and space over the next couple of days. In addition to her suspicions about Victoria Ford and what she had just read about Natalie Ratcliffe's family, she needed to head back to Brooklyn to see if Andre had come through on the passport. After breakfast, she allowed Walt to walk her back to her hotel. Although she couldn't identify what it was, something felt different. Maybe it was the slowly filling sidewalks and the sense that the mass of people coming back to the city were stealing the tranquility she had found over the last couple of days. Or maybe it was the uncertainty about how she and Walt would continue after they finished working together. Whatever it was, she felt uneasy after she kissed Walt goodbye and walked into the Lowell.
She stepped into the elevator and pressed the button for the 8th floor. As she waited for the doors to close, Avery saw Walt on the sidewalk outside. He lifted a hand and waved to her, just as the elevator doors came together and reflected her image back at her. An eerie feeling rippled from the pit of her stomach, strange and foreign. She tried to chalk it up to the reality that their weekend was over. An hour later, though, she still couldn't suppress the feeling that something was wrong. Chapter 52, Manhattan, New York, Monday, July 5th, 2021. Walt drove through the Queens Midtown Tunnel and across the East River. Forest Hills was a small community in Queens where he had tracked down the man he was looking for. Walt was not only surprised that Dr. Jared Lockard, the pathologist who performed the autopsy on Cameron Young, remembered him, but that the doctor was eager to meet. 20 years before, Jared Lockard was known as the wizard for his ability to take apart a corpse and magically find the clues it left behind. Walt imagined the doctor now, 2 decades later, as a stooped-over elderly man who lived alone, never able to marry because so many of his days had been spent so close to death that meaningful connections to the living were impossible. The pit of Walt's gut buzzed with nervous butterflies at the prospect of seeing the wizard after so many years. But he could think of no one else who could better answer the question he had formed while reviewing the lost Cameron Young files. He drove along Austin Street and through the center of town, passing Tudor-styled buildings that lined the quaint shopping area. He turned down a quiet side street and found Dr. Lockhart's home, a 2-story, half-timbered structure that looked well-maintained. He parked in the driveway and walked to the front door, where he rang the bell and wiped his sweaty palms on the sides of his khakis. When the door opened, Walt felt like he was in a time machine. Jared Lockard had not changed from Walt's memory of him. The man still sported a head of wild white hair that looked impossible to tame, even for the most experienced hairdresser. If this feature embarrassed the doctor, it didn't show. Somewhere in his 70s now, the man's face carried the same cavernous folds that curved like parentheses around his lips and accentuated jowls that drooped like melted frosting. Dr. Lockard, Walt Jenkins. Dr. Lockard's lips twisted subtly, the closest he ever came to smiling. Walt remembered how none of the detectives at the BCI had ever been able to read Jared Lockard's mood. His facial expression never veered far from stoic and carried a perpetual look of attending his mother's funeral.
Detective, it's been a while.
Dr. Lockard offered his hand. Walt took it nervously, remembering that shaking hands with Jared Lockard was like squeezing a wet sponge.
20 years, Walt said.
They look to have treated you well.
You too. Walt released his grip. You honestly look the exact same.
So when we worked together 2 decades ago, I look like a 70-year-old man.
No, Walt said, coughing and choking on an errant bolus of saliva. I meant, you look...
Dr. Lockard stared at him without speaking.
Good, that's all, Walt said, looking for a way out of the awkward reunion. You look good.
Was there something on your mind, Detective?
Yes, an old case we worked on together.
The doctor nodded.
Come in.
Walt followed him into the house.
Have a seat,
Dr. Lockard said when they entered the kitchen. The house felt quiet and empty and eerie.
Can I get you something to drink? I've got coffee, still warm.
That would be perfect, Walt said.
Jared Lockard poured 2 cups of coffee and sat with Walt at the kitchen island.
What is it that you need my help with?
Walt took a sip of coffee and felt Dr. Lockard's stare on him. He tried hard to control the irrational nervousness that came from sitting in the man's kitchen.
Do you remember the Cameron Young case?
Dr. Lockard shrugged.
Cameron Young? My favorite dead author. I remember some of it, but that was a long time ago, and I've been retired for a decade now. I have trouble remembering where I left my slippers.
About to refresh the doctor's memory, Walt startled when a black Burmese cat hopped onto the kitchen island, appearing suddenly as if it had been conjured from thin air. It slunk along the far edge of the counter, its back arched and its tail straight up like a snake about to strike. Jade green eyes glowed from the depths of the cat's jet black face, with vertical slits for pupils staring at Walt as if he was trespassing. "Walt," Dr. Lockhart said, reaching for the cat, "where are your manners?" Walt looked slack-jawed from the cat to Dr. Lockhart.
"You have a cat named Walt?"
Dr. Lockhart ran his hat over the cat's back as it purred softly. "Purely coincidence, detective. I've never married, so in lieu of companionship, I have a house full of cats. There are only so many names." Walt shifted his gaze around the kitchen, imagining other feline eyes staring at him from the shadows. Dr. Lockhart looked blankly at Walt as he continued to pet the cat. The edges of his lips eventually curled again into the subtlest of smiles.
"I'm fucking with you, detective."
Walt stayed still for a moment, confused.
"Your cat's not named after me."
"No, this is Mortimer. He's the only cat in the house, and I can't stand the goddamn thing."
Dr. Lockhart lifted the cat off his lap and dropped it onto the ground, where it hissed before scurrying off.
"My wife and I are watching it for our daughter, who's away for the 4th of July holiday, but she's picking the furry thing up this morning, any minute, in fact, so stop sitting there like a prom queen who shit her dress and spit out what it is you need, detective, before my grandchildren swarm this house, because I won't be able to talk about dead authors from 20 years ago after they arrive."
Walt finally smiled.
"I'm not as scary as you think, detective. But my wife hates when I talk about old cases, so let's get this show on the road."
"Got it," Walt said, reaching into the breast pocket of his sport coat and pulling out a piece of paper. "I'm reviewing the Cameron Young case."
"Why?"
"It's a long story. American Events, the television show, is planning to produce a documentary about the case. I'm consulting on the project, and came across something I need your opinion on."
Walt laid the piece of paper on the counter and pointed at it.
"I found this forensics report. Well, not hidden exactly, but not made available at the time of the investigation."
The doctor squinted his eyes as he looked at Walt.
"Who was the prosecutor?"
"Maggie Greenwald."
"Oh, say no more. Square peg Maggie. She had a knack for making evidence disappear."
"Unfortunately. And this case, because of the unusual circumstances, was not one that came under the scrutiny of the Southern District during their investigation of Maggie Greenwald. But I managed to get my hands on it, and I can't figure out a few things I came across."
Dr. Lockhart pulled the page close to him and lifted his chin to see through his bifocals.
"Victoria Ford's urine and blood were discovered at the crime scene. The urine was found in the unflushed toilet. The blood was on the carpeting. DNA analysis confirmed that both the urine and the blood belonged to her. But the forensic report has me confused."
"How so?" Dr. Lockhart asked.
"The report shows that the urine contained a high level of ammonia and that the blood had a series of chemicals in it."
"Chemicals?"
Dr. Lockhart began to read the report.
"Yeah," Walt said. "Listed in trace amounts in the blood were styrene, chloroform, glyphosate, and triclosan. What are they, and are they usually found in blood samples?"
Dr. Lockhart shook his head as he continued to read.
"No, those things are not naturally found in blood."
"How about the ammonia in the urine? Is that normal?"
"No."
"So where did it come from, and what are the chemicals in the blood?"
Dr. Lockhart ran his tongue over the corners of his lips. The wizard, Walt thought, had been conjured. Dr. Lockhart blinked a few times.
"The ammonia is easy. Urea breaks down into ammonia after 24 hours. So the urine collected from the toilet was more than 24 hours old."
Walt considered the timeline. Cameron Young's body was in the early stages of rigor mortis,
and had been hanging for much less than 24 hours.
What about the chemicals in the blood? Walt asked.
Let's see. Styrene is a chemical used to make rubber and plastic products. Chloroform is a solvent and general anesthetic. Glyphosate is, I believe, a pesticide. And triclosan is an antibacterial and antifungal agent.
If the blood at the crime scene belonged to Victoria Ford, Walt said, and we can forensically prove it did, why would she have all those chemicals in her system?
She didn't, Dr. Lockhart said.
He stood up and walked to the kitchen nook to grab his laptop. He returned to the island, opened the computer, and began tapping on the keyboard. Walt looked at the monitor just as Dr. Lockhart finished typing into the search engine. Walt saw the query, chemicals found in tampons. Dr. Lockhart nodded, pointing at the monitor.
The styrene came from the plastic applicator of a tampon. The chloroform is an anesthetic because, you know, women push babies out of their bodies, but corporations don't believe they're tough enough to handle a tampon. Glyphosate is a pesticide used in cotton crops that sadly finds its way into cotton tampons. And finally, the triclosan is used as a preservative to prevent contamination.
Walt hesitated as he too stared at the monitor, trying to make sense of it. Dr. Lockhart turned from the screen and looked at Walt.
If I were involved with this case, more than simply performing the post-mortem exam on the victim, the chemicals found in the crime scene blood, as well as the ammonia in the urine, would raise some serious red flags.
Red flags for what?
That the urine was badly preserved before being placed in the toilet, and that the blood had been harvested from a tampon and planted at the scene.
Chapter 53. Manhattan, New York. Monday, July 5th, 2021.
It was approaching 6 p.m. when Avery rode the elevator up to Natalie Ratcliffe's apartment and was again met by the author when the doors opened.
Avery, good to see you again.
Hi, Avery said.
I didn't think you'd finish so fast. I've been done for a day or two. Come on inside.
Avery followed Natalie into the apartment. She had called Natalie after breakfast to ask if she had finished writing the chronology of her relationship with Victoria Ford.
I wasn't even sure you'd be in town. The city was eerily empty this past weekend, Avery said.
I know. I actually came back to the city from our Lake Norman house for that exact reason. I'm behind on a deadline, and there are too many distractions there. The empty city was a godsend. It kept me focused on my manuscript all weekend because there was nothing else going on.
I hope my request didn't put you more behind.
Not at all. I enjoyed putting it together. It was like taking a stroll down memory lane, recounting my friendship with Victoria. Natalie walked through the French doors of her office. Avery again saw Natalie's books arranged on the built-in shelves. Natalie came back out of the office and handed Avery a folder.
That's a point-by-point overview of my relationship with Victoria, ever since we first met as college freshmen. I hope it answers all your questions and provides some insight into who she was and what a dear friend she always was to me.
Avery took the folder and opened it. Inside were several typed pages.
Thank you for doing this. It will certainly go a long way to showing my audience who Victoria was. Together with everything Emma has provided, I should be able to paint a complete picture of her. In the fall, are you willing to give a full interview? My team would be with me then, and we'd be recording and producing it for American events.
Natalie nodded.
For sure.
Excellent. I don't want to take too much of your time, Avery said, so thank you again.
Of course.
As I walked toward the door, Avery spoke.
I read that when you get to the end of each manuscript, you head to Greece for a month to finish it up.
This bit of information had been provided by Christine in one of her many text messages. The sudden change in subject matter appeared to catch Natalie off guard, which was Avery's point. Natalie slowly nodded.
That's been my routine for many years, yes.
How close are you now?
To what?
To finishing your latest manuscript.
Natalie smiled and released what Avery interpreted to be a nervous laugh.
Not close enough.
But you'll be going soon, to Greece.
I hope to, yes.
To Santorini, actually,
Avery said in a casual way, meant to let Natalie know Avery had been doing some digging. Actually, it was Christine who'd done the digging.
You have a villa on the small island of Santorini, don't you?
Natalie gave another nervous laugh.
I try not to talk too much about my private life or about where I own homes. Some of my readers are, let's just say they're very interested in the specifics of my life, and I try to stay as private as possible.
Avery nodded. Understood. I have viewers that are the same way. I'd never release any of that information about your home in Santorini. I was just curious, for my own reasons, about whether you'll be visiting there soon.
Natalie smiled.
Yes, I'll be going to Santorini to put the finishing touches on my latest manuscript.
Why Santorini?
Avery saw that Natalie became even more uncomfortable now.
I mean, I'm sure it's beautiful, but so are Napa Valley and Lake Tahoe and 1,000 other places. You know, to get away and write a book. Didn't Stephen King finish The Shining at a hotel in Colorado?
I'm not sure where Stephen King does his writing.
I'm just wondering what's so special about Santorini. It sounds so far away and so remote.
Natalie shrugged.
It's just where I've always gone. I wish there were a better story behind it.
Maybe your muse is there? Avery asked in an offhanded way.
She looked back down to the folder and the history Natalie had created about her relationship with Victoria. Eventually, Avery looked up and made eye contact with Natalie.
Did you know that the medical examiner identified Victoria from a single tooth?
Avery watched the shock register on Natalie's face.
Can you believe that?
There was no answer.
From the rubble of the Twin Towers, a single tooth was recovered. I didn't believe such a thing could be possible at first, until the methodology was explained to me.
Avery paused a moment, but held Natalie's gaze without blinking.
Nothing else, though. No other specimens were discovered that belonged to Victoria. No other bone fragments, no portions of her jaw, just that one tooth.
Avery smiled and looked back down at the folder.
Anyway, I just found it interesting.
She held up the notes.
Thanks for the history. I'll let you get back to your writing. Good luck finishing your manuscript.
Thank you, Natalie said, her voice shaky and hesitant.
Emma gave me some boxes that contained a bunch of Victoria's old keepsakes. I found a flash drive that had all of her manuscripts on it, lost manuscripts stored in an attic for 2 decades.
Natalie cocked her head to the side and feigned a smile.
Is that right?
Emma told me that Victoria didn't share her manuscripts with anyone, not Emma, not even Jasper. No one, in fact, has ever read them before. So I was a little hesitant to read them myself. It felt like I was intruding on her privacy.
Did you?
Did I what?
Read any of her manuscripts?
Oh, all of them. They're really good.
Avery turned and opened the door.
They remind me a lot of your writing.
Avery waited for a reply. When none came, she walked out into the hallway and headed for the elevator.
Chapter 54. Manhattan, New York, Tuesday, July 6th, 2021.
It was just past 8 a.m. on Tuesday morning when Avery took the elevator to the lobby, cut across the marble floor, and pushed through the front door. The valet had her Range Rover parked out front with the engine running. Avery climbed in and pulled away.
The streets were crowded. Taxis beeped. Cyclists darted through traffic as they transported their packages, and a steady stream of pedestrians filled the sidewalks. The long weekend was over, and the city had taken back its role as the financial capital of the world. The relaxed and welcoming looks Avery had received on her run through Central Park Sunday morning were replaced by stoic expressions of those on the way to work. The sun was low and bright when she made it to the George Washington Bridge, and it filled her rearview mirror until she made it into New Jersey and headed north on Palisades Interstate Parkway. Smooth reggae drifted from the car's speakers and was Avery's attempt to calm her nerves. On her mind was the postcard she had ripped to shreds months earlier before painstakingly taping it back together. She had somehow managed to misplace it since she arrived in New York, and she took the card's absence as an omen that what she was planning was about to go wrong. She had told everyone, her agent, her friends at HAP News, Christine Swanson, Walt Jenkins, and even Livia Cuddy, that she had come all the way across the country to chase the story of Victoria Ford. But this morning's drive was the real reason. In addition to her rendezvous planned for tomorrow with the German man named Andre, whom she had paid thousands of dollars to create a false passport, this morning's trip to the mountains was the reason Avery had come so far. It was the reason she had driven her Range Rover rather than purchased an airline ticket. It was why she had paid in cash for everything she had done on this trip, avoiding her credit card at all costs. She was nearly certain about what she would find, but needed confirmation before she proceeded. The trip to Lake Placid took over 4 hours. Avery remembered the torturous journeys from her childhood. It seemed like days, not hours, to get from the city to the mountains. But she also remembered the joy of finally arriving at her aunt's cabin. The lineage of the property's owners had been immaterial when she was a kid visiting the cabin for the last weekend of summer, just before school was to resume. An annual excursion the Montgomery family took each year to celebrate Avery's and Christopher's safe return home from sailing camp. It was their salute to the end of summer. Back then, Avery was more interested in swimming in the lake and swinging on the long rope attached to the branch of a sycamore tree that hung over the water. A thousand times over, that knotted rope had sent Avery and her brother off the edge of a rock and out into the lake, where they'd release their grip and splash into the water. Time at Ma Bell's cabin came only once a summer, but represented significant real estate in Avery's memories because of the glorious time she and Christopher shared there with their cousins. The cabin was not a Montgomery property. Had it been, it would be 3 times as large and perched on a lake 10 times the size. The latest and most expensive trends in architecture would have replaced the cabin's rustic quaintness. A fleet of powerboats and jet skis would have lined the shoreline. Everything would have been ornate and overdone. It also would have been repossessed by the United States government, like every other property Garth Montgomery had owned. But Ma Bell's cabin was none of those things. It was simple and charming, and far removed from anything Avery's family owned. It was an oasis from the glitz and wealth that followed the Montgomerys everywhere they went. The cabin held for Avery the same appeal as Connie Clarkson's sailing camp. Avery had never been happier than when she was tucked away for summer nights in cabin number 12 in Sister Bay, Wisconsin. She found the same joy each year when she visited Ma Bell's cabin in Lake Placid. As a child, Avery never knew how she was actually related to Ma Bell. The road to get there was too complicated for Avery and her brother to ever explore. Ma Bell was the second cousin of Avery's uncle, and just far enough removed from the Montgomery bloodline to stay off the Fed's radar. There was no direct link to the Montgomery family, and as soon as the postcard had arrived, Avery knew where her father had been hiding. The 3 sevens written at the bottom of the postcard represented the cabin's address, 777 Stony Brook Circle, Lake Placid, New York. "Welcome to the Sevens," Ma Bell used to say when they arrived each August. How long her father had been there, and in what kind of shape he was in,
Avery had no idea. She only knew that she came this far for a reason. And she wasn't going to allow anything to derail her plans, not her doubts, not her fear, and certainly not her goddamn conscience. The mountain roads were as serpentine as she remembered when Avery meandered through the final leg of her journey. She slowed when she made the last turn. The road in front of her, which at its conclusion led to the cabin's driveway, was speckled with the morning sun and shadowed by the foliage of the forest around her. She drove to the end of the street and stopped. In front of her was the quaint A-frame cabin sided with cedar and perched at the precipice of a hill that dropped off to the lake behind it. The driveway was unpaved, and the gravel was packed down in two ruts with a shallow mound of rocks between them. She saw a car parked at the end of the drive. She didn't recognize it. The mailbox, however, held the numbers of the cabin's address. When she came here as a child, the 37s were bright red and vibrant. Today, they were ruddy and weather-worn. There was motion inside the house. A figure passed in front of the window and appeared to pause for a moment. Avery noticed the curtains flutter, and she imagined him peering carefully around the window's edge at the fire-red Range Rover stopped in the middle of the street. She almost pulled into the driveway. She almost parked behind the car and climbed the front steps to knock on the door. Almost. Instead, she turned right and pulled away. Speaking directly with her father had never been part of the plan. It couldn't be. But she had to come. She had to see the cabin again. She had to make sure. Confirmation was most definitely part of her plan. The rest, Avery could only hope would work. She pulled a U-turn in the cul-de-sac and started her drive back to the city. Walt Jenkins drove his unmarked government SUV, the keys to which Jim Oliver had handed him on his first night back in New York. He nearly pulled down Stony Brook Circle after he had seen Avery's red Range Rover make the turn. Instincts, however, told him not to. It was a good thing. After he spotted her vehicle stopped in the middle of the road in front of a gravel drive, she had turned around and come back his way. The winding, empty mountain roads did not make the best environments to tail someone. He watched her turn and head back toward the city. Walt was happy to give her a bit of room. He turned onto Stony Brook Circle now and stopped in the same spot Avery's Range Rover had been a moment before. There was only a single isolated home on this short stretch of road. He resisted the urge to park on the shoulder and check the place out. That was not his job. He was on a surveillance operation, and his goal was to collect information and pass it on to Jim Oliver. He used his cell phone to take a few photos of the A-frame cabin and the wooded area on either side of it. Then he twisted the steering wheel and pulled close to the mailbox, where he snapped a photo of the address. His mind quickly made the connection between the faded sevens on the mailbox and the numbers that were scrawled on the postcard he had seen in Avery's hotel room. Walt dropped his phone on the passenger seat, twisted the car around, and accelerated to catch up with Avery. Chapter 55. Manhattan, New York, Wednesday, July 7th, 2021. On Wednesday morning, 1 week since she met Andre Schwarzkopf, Avery sat on the F train and bounced toward Brooklyn for her second meeting with the mysterious man she had been put in touch with. The same ripple of worry that had originated when she watched Walt outside her hotel on Monday morning was back again now. This was the crux of the plan. Once she had the passport, everything else had a chance of working. Without it, there was no chance at all. She tucked her purse tight to her side as the subway rocked along the tracks. In her purse was the remaining cash for the purchase. She hoped for a quick exchange this time around. She imagined standing on the front stoop of the brownstone and ringing the bell.
Andre opening the door and handing her the passport in exchange for the rest of the payment. Then she would be off and done with the shady business of procuring false documents. Other things would have to go her way for it all to work, but this was the next critical step in the arduous journey she had started long ago. Despite an array of empty seats on the subway car, a man sat down in the seat next to her, trapping Avery between him and the window. He wore Bose headphones that barely muffled the music that blistered from them. She tucked her purse closer to her side. The man stared straight ahead and ignored her. The train made a stop and the sliding doors opened. A few passengers exited and were replaced by others who boarded. Avery thought for a moment of telling the man that she needed to exit the train, despite her stop in Brooklyn being 30 minutes away. Before she could muster the nerve, the doors closed, and the train rocked back into motion. Music continued to blare from the man's headphones. A few minutes later, the train slowed for another stop. The man reached into his backpack, which rested on his lap, and pulled out an envelope. He dropped it casually onto Avery's lap, never looking at her. "Change of plans," the man said, staring straight ahead. When the train stopped this time, the man stood abruptly. Before she could ask a question, he was up and through the sliding doors as soon as they opened. She watched through the window as the man pulled the backpack over his shoulders, walked through the turnstiles, and jogged up the stairs. Avery waited for the train to start moving before she picked up the envelope. It was not sealed. She slid the index card from within and read it.
9/11 Memorial, North Reflecting Pool. Wait for me there. Andre.
Avery looked around the car, wondering what was happening. The image of her making a fast exchange with Andre on the front porch of his brownstone was replaced now with images of her being arrested and placed in the back of a police cruiser, hands cuffed behind her back. She looked up at the map to see where she was. The financial district was two stops away. She thought of calling the whole thing off and ending this nonsense, of exiting the subway on the next stop and hailing a cab back to the Lowell. But that would mean ending the plan before it had a chance to work. The train slowed and stopped. She stayed seated and watched the faces of the passengers exiting and entering the car. The doors closed and the train took off. Her right foot tapped away to expel her anxiety. When the doors opened at Fulton Street, she was up and out of her seat and hurrying out of the subway. She walked up the steps of the platform. The empty sidewalks she had known over the weekend were indeed gone, replaced now by hundreds of commuters and tourists. She walked west on Fulton for 3 blocks, looked over her shoulder as she did, until she came to the 9/11 memorial. She passed the white oak trees that populated the memorial grounds. She stopped when she made it to the North Reflecting Pool, which occupied the footprint where the North Tower once stood. In its place was now a square hole in the ground lined by granite. Water cascaded elegantly down each side of the memorial, and Avery took a moment to listen to its soft murmur. It was easy to hear because, despite the size of the crowd around her, everyone was silent. The tourists were overcome by a natural tendency for calm and respect at this sacred place where so many lives were lost. Avery ran her finger across the names engraved on bronze parapets that rimmed the top of the reflecting pools. She moved along the perimeter, following the list of names. They were not in alphabetical order, she knew, but instead grouped together to represent whom the victims might have been with when they died. It took a few minutes before she found Victoria Ford's name. Avery traced her finger across the engraving and thought of all she had learned about the woman in the last couple of weeks. Lost for a moment in her thoughts, Avery did not notice the man standing next to her until he spoke.
"There's a food truck on Greenwich Street, 1 block over," the man said. "Order a Reuben with extra slaw, exactly that way."
The man wore sunglasses and a golf shirt tucked into jeans. He looked like any of the hundreds of other tourists taking in the sights. "What's going on? Where's Andre?"
"Reuben with extra slaw, got it?" Avery nodded, and the man was gone before she could speak another word. She wanted to follow after him, chase him down, figure out what was wrong. Was something wrong, or was this just how Andre did business? But instead, she stayed where she was and continued to stare down into the reflecting pool. Her gaze moved back to Victoria's name etched in the bronze. She slowly counted to 60 before she moved. Why 60 and not 100? Why wait at all and not just run to the food truck? So far out of her element, she had no idea the answer to any of these questions, only an instinct that told her something was desperately wrong. After a minute, she casually walked to Greenwich Street and found the food truck. She was fourth in line. The service was painfully slow, and with each passing minute, she felt her pulse rising. Her forehead and neck became beaded with perspiration. When she made it to the window, a man stood with a pencil at the ready, hovering it over a pad of paper. "Reuben, with extra slaw." The man in the truck didn't hesitate. He wore a white apron. Reading glasses hung on the end of his nose.
"Fries?"
No, Avery said.
"Something to drink?"
"Just a sandwich. Reuben, with extra slaw." She spoke the word slowly for the man to hear each syllable.
$10.50, he said,
never once peering over his cheaters. Avery hesitated before she paid the man, moved to the side, and waited for her order. A few minutes later, a plastic bag was dropped onto the shelf outside the second window of the food truck.
"Reuben, extra slaw,"
a woman yelled. Avery walked over and retrieved her sandwich. She looked inside, just a quick glance. It was all that was needed. An envelope accompanied her Reuben. It took all her discipline to stop from reaching into the bag to grab it. Instead, she walked another block and sat on a bench before she opened the bag. She pulled out the envelope and opened it. Another index card.
"Old St. Pat's Church. Walk. No subway. No cab. Andre."
Avery looked up from the note. Her gaze moved around the sidewalk and street. No one, it seemed, was paying her any attention. Despite this observation, she still felt terribly exposed, as if unseen eyes were watching her. With her heart rate spiking and the perspiration rolling down the small of her back, she stood from the bench and headed east on Fulton Street. When she reached Broadway, she turned left and started the 2-mile trek north to Old St. Pat's Cathedral. It took 30 minutes. The noon mass was comfortably crowded and well in progress when Avery found a spot in the back pew. She sang with the parishioners. For 30 minutes, she sat and stood and sat again, scanning the crowd for Andre. She stayed seated during communion. After the final blessing was offered, the church slowly emptied. She failed to recognize a suspicious face. If she were being followed, those who were on the prowl were invisible. She sat in the back pew of the cathedral, the long center aisle to her left. 10 minutes after the service ended, a few patrons still occupied the church. Some knelt in the front pews, deep in prayer. Others walked the center aisle with necks craned heavenward, admiring the ornate cathedral ceiling and the splendid beauty of the church. A few people snapped photos. Avery spotted him walking up the side aisle. Andre moved slowly and acted like the other tourists in the church, looking up at the ceiling and around the cavernous interior. He wore jeans and a sport coat. His midsection threatened to pop the single button holding the coat together. His beady eyes darted around behind the tiny wireless glasses, and Avery noticed a large manila envelope in his right hand. He entered the pew from the side aisle and walked the entire length of it until he sat next to her.
"What's going on?" Avery whispered.
"You're being followed."
"What? How do you know this?"
"You're blown in the worst way, probably a mutual friend as well, I'm sorry to say."
The German Brooklyn accent made his rapid speech difficult to follow. Andre placed the manila envelope on the pew between them. Evie sinks inside.
The passport?
Andre nodded and stood to leave.
Who's following me?
He pointed to the envelope.
Everything you need to know is there. Good luck.
I still owe you money, Avery said.
Andre shook his head.
I owed him a favor. Let him know we're now even, and whatever it is you have planned, I'd do it quickly. I doubt you have much time.
Andre skirted past her and into the middle aisle. Avery twisted in the pew to watch him exit the church, walk down the steps, and disappear into the crowd. She sat unmoving for another minute, until finally she lifted the manila envelope, resisted the urge to look inside, and quickly hurried out of the church. It was a straight shot up Broadway near Old St. Pat's, then east to the Lowell. 12 blocks that she power-walked in 10 minutes, through the lobby and into the elevator, all the while she clutched the envelope to her chest. It wasn't until she bolted and chained her hotel room door that she finally opened the manila envelope. Sitting on the edge of her bed, she fumbled with the envelope's button and string clasp. When she finally had the flap open, she poured the contents onto the bed. A blue passport tumbled onto the comforter. She examined it. It looked exactly like a U.S. passport, blue exterior with gold embossed letters. She opened the front cover and saw the picture she had given Andre last week. She read the name aloud.
Aaron Holland.
It had a delightful ring to it. As much joy came from seeing the passport, something else sat in the pit of her stomach. She felt no relief having made it this far. She felt terror and dread, and couldn't stop the sensation that the manila envelope held her worst fears. She dropped the passport back on the bed and looked into the envelope. She caught the reflection of glossy photos and reached in to retrieve them. Several 8x10 photos emerged from the envelope. Avery saw that each was a still photo of Walt Jenkins.
Chapter 56. Manhattan, New York, Wednesday, July 7th, 2021. Avery sat at the small desk in her hotel room. The photos of Walt lay before her, scattered across the surface. Avery had carefully scrutinized each picture. As Andre indicated, they told Avery everything she needed to know. The first photo was of Walt in jeans, windbreaker, and ball cap. In the background were the headstones of Greenwood Cemetery. He had followed her the day after their first meeting when she'd gone to visit her mother's grave. A second photo was of Walt crouching next to Christopher's headstone while he held a cell phone to his ear. The next was an image of Walt standing in the shadows between two brownstones in Brooklyn. Finally, there were photos of Walt sitting behind the wheel of his SUV, sunglasses covering his eyes, and Ma Bell's cabin in the background. He'd followed her to Andre's brownstone. He'd followed her to the cemetery. He'd followed her out to Lake Placid. Some combination of disbelief, anger, and embarrassment befell her as she paged through the photos. Had she been so naive to believe that the United States government would stop searching for her father? Had she believed that her amateurish attempts to fly under the radar on this trip to New York would really deceive the Federal Bureau of Investigation? The feds had tracked her down in L.A. a couple of years earlier and asked a slew of questions about her father. She hadn't lied when she told them that she had no idea where her father was. At the time, she didn't. Only after the postcard arrived had Avery figured it out. Bile bubbled up her esophagus and deposited a bitter taste in the back of her throat at the notion that Walt had slept with her in order to gain information about her father's whereabouts. More acid followed when she admitted that she had allowed herself to feel something for him. Was she such a poor judge of character to miss all the red flags? Was she so desperate for companionship that she allowed his story of betrayal to resonate with her own? Was that part of Walt's past even true? Couldn't she see how convenient it all was that the detective in the Cameron Young case, now a retired agent of the FBI, was so eager to help when she called?
Had her ego as a respected television journalist clouded her reason?
Damn it!
She shouted as she swiped the photos to the floor. Just then there was a knock on the door. She looked up from the desk and froze. After a moment, another knock came. Three hurried taps. Avery quickly gathered the photos from the floor, noticing that one had slid under the couch. She stuffed them back into the envelope and then reached beneath the couch to retrieve the last photo. Coincidentally, or perhaps an omen of the situation she had found herself in, when she reached under the couch to retrieve the photo, she also discovered her father's postcard. The photo that had skidded under the couch was of Walt in his SUV, studying the cabin when he followed Avery out to Lake Placid. She pushed away the worry about what it all might mean, that not only Walt Jenkins, but the United States government knew everything about what she had painstakingly planned for the last year. Another knock came from the door. She stuffed the photo and the postcard into the manila envelope and dropped it on the desk. She checked her reflection in the mirror, frustrated that her red-rimmed eyes and bloated face revealed her vulnerability and would allow him to see that his actions had hurt her. Avery hated the feeling of weakness, but there was no way to hide it, and she wasn't about to run from this confrontation. In fact, she longed for it. She walked over to the door and ripped it open. Natalie Ratcliffe stood in the hallway. "Hi," Natalie said. "Is this a bad time?" Avery blinked a few times.
No.
She shook her head. "I wasn't expecting to see you, that's all."
"Everything okay?"
Avery recognized the concern in Natalie's voice. Where men may retreat in paranoia at the sight of a woman crying, women pounce on the opportunity to help.
"Working out some man-related crap, that's all," Avery said.
"Is there another kind?" Avery forced a smile.
"Can I come in?" Natalie asked.
Avery nodded and moved to the side. Natalie walked past her.
"How did you know where I was staying?"
"Pulled some strings," Natalie said.
"Meaning?"
"Meaning I needed to talk with you after how you left things the other day. And I didn't want to wait for a call back, so I figured out where you were staying."
"Fair enough." Avery closed the door. "What's on your mind?"
"You can't do what you're about to do." Avery opened the mini fridge and pulled out a bottle of water, took a sip.
"What am I about to do?"
Natalie took a deep breath and exhaled it audibly.
"You think you know the whole story, but you don't."
"Oh, I'm sure I don't know the half of it, but I'm pretty sure I figured out the most important part. Victoria is not dead, is she?"
There was a stretch of silence that filled the hotel room, interrupted only by the occasional car horn that penetrated up from the street. "Victoria was in an impossible position. She was no saint, and I'd never argue otherwise. She was having an affair with a married man, but she was looking at going to prison for a crime she didn't commit."
Avery saw Natalie swallow hard, on the verge of crying.
"She didn't kill Cameron Young," Natalie said.
"I know, or at least I think I know. I took a deep dive into the case and the evidence and some other things that were not made public about the investigation."
"How?"
"With the detective." Even peripherally saying Walt's name brought her to the edge of tears.
"Who ran the investigation?"
"Can you prove it?" Natalie asked.
"That Victoria is innocent?"
"No, not this many years later. But I can certainly make a compelling argument that the crime scene was staged to make it look like she did it, and that's all I need to do for my show."
There was a long pause as they stared at each other.
"She did the only thing she could to survive," Natalie said. "She disappeared because there was no other way, not because she was guilty."
"She couldn't have done it alone."
She didn't. I helped her. And Emma?
Natalie paused before answering.
No, Emma has no idea.
Avery mulled this over and ran through the possibilities.
Avery, I'm asking you not to do this. There will be very serious and real consequences if you tell people about this.
It would ruin your writing career, that's for sure. You'd probably go to prison.
I don't care about my career. It's not mine to care about. It's Victoria's. I'm just a facilitator.
She writes the manuscripts, doesn't she? Sends them to you, and then you publish them under your name and brand.
Natalie nodded. It's a collaboration, but yes.
She took a step closer to Avery.
But it's not a writing career you'd be ruining. It's a life. A new life, fought for and scratched for and obtained against all odds.
She's in Greece, isn't she? You helped her to somehow get to the island of Santorini. Your husband's family owns a villa there. You see her every year to finish the new manuscript.
Avery saw a look of confusion come over Natalie's face as the 20-year-old secret was laid before her.
Please, don't expose what you know about Victoria. I am begging you, Avery.
Avery looked over at the desk and the manila envelope that held the photos of Walt Jenkins. She looked back at Natalie Ratcliffe.
Maybe there's a way we can help each other.
How?
Your husband's family owns a cruise line. It's a private company, no outside money, no outside influences. I think that's how you and Victoria pulled it off. Somehow you used your husband's cruise line to get Victoria out of the country after 9/11. I can't totally figure it out, but I need to know how you did it.
Why? If not to expose her, why do you need to know the details?
Avery looked again to the manila envelope on the desk, then back to Natalie Ratcliffe.
Because I too need to get someone out of the country.
Chapter 57, Lake Placid, New York, Thursday, July 8th, 2021. Close scrutiny of the two hikers making their way through the trails of the Adirondack Mountains near Lake Placid would reveal boots that were too new, gear that was too clean, and rucksacks filled with surveillance equipment foreign to even the most ardent bird watchers. But thankfully, the two hikers, a man and a woman, never saw another soul on the trail.
"I think the blister on my foot just popped," he said.
"You're such a man," the woman said.
"It hurts like a son of a bitch."
"Childbirth hurts. Blisters on your toe are an annoyance," she said, hiking up ahead and forcing him to hurry after her. They trekked 3 miles from the national park where they had parked their car. It took nearly an hour, mostly because of her partner's low pain tolerance, to make it to the precipice of the hill that offered a bird's-eye view of the valley below. A trail descended into the basin and wrapped around the lake at the bottom. The peaks of the Adirondacks rose before them and marked the northern border of Lake Placid. It would be, on another day, a time to pause and take in the beauty of the outdoors, the majesty of the morning, and the glory of midsummer Lake Placid. But today was not any morning. The two hikers had information to gather and a deadline to keep. The woman started down the trail. A few minutes later, her partner limped after her. When they made it down to the lake, they had a clear view of the homes perched on the foothills in front of them. The female agent slipped her rucksack off her shoulders and unzipped the top. She removed a long-range Nikon camera with a telescopic lens and had the focus adjusted perfectly by the time her partner joined her.
"How are those new boots treating you?" she asked. "Like my ex-wife."
She raised her right eyebrow and looked at him out of the corner of her eye.
"Nasty and unforgiving," he said.
"Get your gear out and start looking at birds," she said.
The mail agent unzipped his own rucksack and pulled out bird-watching binoculars that looked as innocuous as a child's telescope. The female agent stood behind him for cover and pulled out a much more powerful pair of binoculars. She held them to her eyes and focused the lenses on the A-frame cabin across the lake. Perched at the top of a small hill, the high-range binoculars gave her the ability to see into the windows of the cabin from 400 yards away. The cabin's nearest neighbor was 10 acres to the north. The terrain on this side of the house consisted of a wooden deck and a long row of stairs that ran down to the water. A sycamore stood at the water's edge, where a rope swing hung from a limb and teetered over the surface of the lake. The agent put the binoculars down and picked up the Nikon. "Clear?" she asked. Her partner took a moment to confirm that there were no eyes on them. "Clear," he said. The female agent began snapping photos of the A-frame cabin, the lake, and the forested area on either side of the structure. The images would be used to organize the tactical raid the feds were planning on the isolated cabin, but they'd need a warrant before they could crash through the front door. To secure one, they would have to confirm that their subject was present inside and prove to a judge that it was Garth Montgomery. "Okay," the female agent said, dropping the camera and binoculars back into the rucksack. "Let's see how close we can get."